Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. More than 60,000 patients in the U.S. receive general anesthesia every day. It's so routine, most of us don't think to question it. But despite the fact that anesthesia drugs have been around for more than 150 years, we still don't understand much about how they work. That's where my next guest comes in. Dr. Emery Brown has, quite frankly, too many prestigious titles to list them all. But we'll just say he's a professor at both Harvard and MIT and director of the Harvard-MIT Health Sciences and Technology Program. He joins me now via Skype. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Anesthesia was created as a practical tool for surgery to eliminate pain. But it's kind of a fascinating neurological phenomenon in and of itself. And in fact, you describe it as a combination of five different phenomena. Can you just break that down for us?
Yes. I mean, the state of general anesthesia consists of having a patient be unconscious, not feeling pain, not remembering, not moving around, and then doing all that and keeping them hemodynamically stable, and also doing it in a way so that you can reverse it, because the patient needs to be in this condition so he or she can have surgery, but then you need to bring them out of it. So it's this, what I've referred to as like a drug-induced reversible coma, actually.
Don't things, though, like paralysis and amnesia usually go along with unconsciousness? How separate really are those phenomena?
Well, so being unconscious and moving, we see all the time, because you see patients who are in comas who move all the time. So just because you're unconscious doesn't necessarily mean that you won't be moving. However, you are right. If you're profoundly unconscious, then it's most likely that you're not going to be able to form memories.
How different is anesthesia and that state of unconsciousness from something like just being asleep at night?
Anesthesia is not sleep. All right. When you're asleep, I can shake you and awake you. Under anesthesia, you're in a state, as I said, it's a drug-induced reversible coma, and you're insensate so that you can tolerate something which would otherwise be traumatic. So it's profoundly different from being in the unconscious state of sleep.
Now, the search for anesthetics goes way back for obvious reasons. I mean, even just a tooth extraction a couple hundred years ago would have been extremely painful. And by about the mid-1800s, you know, we had people experimenting with nitrous, ether, chloroform. I'm kind of curious how doctors find and test new anesthetics, because we've got a whole range of them at this point. How do you actually go about finding new anesthetics?
So let me just go through a few things here. So the first public demonstration of anesthesia took place in 1846 at Mass General Hospital on October 16th, and at that time the drug used was ether. And just to cut to the chase, we still use ether-based drugs. In addition, we have a whole other range of drugs which we use to create the state of what we call balanced anesthesia, where we use combinations of various drugs to achieve those states that I mentioned. And the idea is that using small amounts of many different drugs gives you more of the good effects and fewer of the side effects. So just to give you a rough idea, in the course of a standard anesthetic, a patient will receive a minimum of 10 drugs. That's just even for like a simple procedure.
Really?
So we rely very heavily on combinations of drugs.
In 2005, science actually considered figuring out how all those drugs do their jobs to be one of the most important unsolved mysteries of modern medicine. I mean, you're talking about balancing very carefully the physiological state of a person in surgery, using multiple different drugs. Obviously, we've gotten pretty good, at least empirically, at using these drugs. Why is it so important to understand how they do what they do?
Well, just like anything else, you can go a long way and be quite successful empirically. And once you're able to understand things, you can imagine things that you couldn't even imagine before. And I have to just basically qualify something you said at the outset, which is we really don't understand how anesthesia works. I think in the last few years, we've gained a lot of insight into how the drugs do work. And the answer is kind of simple, right? It's not as complex or as mysterious as it might have been made out to be. And I think that this perception of mystery has come out of the fact that we did not understand what was going on, but it turns out to be pretty straightforward. And I can tell you in two sentences, when you administer these drugs, they create oscillations in the brain, which basically disrupt information flow among the different parts of the brain. You maintain the drugs there, you maintain the oscillations, and they actually prevent the various parts of your brain from communicating. You turn off the drugs, the oscillations essentially subside, and now you come back. That's basically what happens.
And what is it we're really talking about when you say oscillations, a sort of brainwaves, electrical activity in the brain that's blocking other normal brain function?
That's precisely what I'm talking about. And so the brain is this large electrical chemical entity. And at any point in time, you're using a combination of oscillations as well as the electrical discharges from neurons, which we call spikes or action potentials, to communicate. So what happens is that when you administer these drugs, they basically hijack these electrical potentials and they make them travel in highly systematic ways, which don't allow the various parts of the brain to communicate. And what it is it's like me talking to you right now and you hearing my voice. And then if all of a sudden, you know, a large hum came down the phone line, or down, in this case, the Skype waves, and went wah. That hum is preventing me from transmitting information to you in the form of this conversation. And that is effectively what the anesthetics are doing. Because when you look at the brain waves, if you compare the size of the brain waves when someone is awake to the size of they are when they're under anesthesia, they're a couple orders of magnitude larger in many cases, indicating that the drugs are disrupting communication in a very, very structured and systematic way.
I mean, it sounds like the drugs aren't turning the brain off, which might be the instinctual thing to think that they're doing, but instead they're like switching on some sort of jamming system. But that jamming system has to be generated by the brain, right? Do we understand how those drugs turn it on and what that system is that creates those oscillations?
Oh, sure. That's we have a lot of insight into that. So if you take drugs like propofol or like the ethers, propofol is, you know, our most widely used anesthetic. They work on certain circuits in the brain or certain receptors in the brain which enhance inhibition. So when the drug hits those various targets, the areas that where those targets are located are affected, and then the connections between various regions where those targets are generate these oscillations. So now when you change the drug and the drug has different targets, you hit different circuits in the brain and you generate different oscillations.
How do you go about studying this and figuring it out? Is this something that you're mostly working on in animals in the lab, or are you actually looking at the brain activity of human beings as they're going through surgeries?
So that's what I was about to say a second ago. One of the really great things about this research is that you can see these oscillations very easily in patients who are having surgery just by putting an electroencephalogram or EEG strip just on their foreheads. The oscillations are that strong and that obvious. So we've learned a lot just from studying the patients that I take care of when I'm in the operating room. Then we've also done structured studies in, you know, patients as well as in volunteers, and we've gone ahead and done detailed recordings both in non-human primates, meaning monkeys, and also in rodents. So we've used all of these systems to put this together. In addition, we've coupled that with mathematical modeling to sort of test out, you know, in simulation, some of the ideas that we've, hypotheses that we've had from our observations and our experiments.
You mentioned the mathematical modeling that you do and looking at kind of normal brain function and how information is transferred around the brain. Do you see anything like this kind of jamming system, these oscillations that are induced by anesthesia under any other circumstances, or is this really unique?
Anesthesia has its own unique dynamics. I mean, this is not something, in other words, you can't infer this from looking at what happens to people in sleep. You see some overlap with certain states of coma or maybe when patients are hypothermic, for certain anesthetic states. But overall, anesthesia is its own unique set of conditions. And that's one of the reasons why it's so fascinating to study, because studying it from the perspective that I'm talking to you about now, that is realizing that it's creating brain dynamics, and these brain dynamics tell us how the drugs alter activity across different brain regions. It's actually like another probe of brain function that gives us insight into the fundamental workings of various parts of the brain.
That was actually going to be my next question for you. I mean, could you use this essentially as an experimental tool to better understand the brain? Is it, first of all, something that we can use in a precise enough manner? And then what kinds of questions might you be able to ask using anesthesia?
Well, I'll give you some insights into a couple things that we've just learned. And these are just, you know, what I would call experiments of nature. So, for example, we've just observing. This comes about from just observing the EEG of patients of different age groups. And one of the things that is very obvious is that there's a systematic change in the structure of the oscillations as a function of age. The oscillations are very limited when children are quite young, let's say about less than 3 months of age. They start to take on a shape that begins to look adult-like after about 4 months, but they don't really have the full adult character until, let's say, the kids are about a year. Then they grow to an amazingly large amplitude when kids are about six or eight years of age. And then from there on, they decline in amplitude as we get older, you know, across our, you know, early adulthood, you know, middle age, the elderly life period. And what we've come to appreciate is that these changes, again, they are quite systematic. They reflect brain development in the younger children, and they reflect brain aging in adults.
Does that also come through in a clinical sense? Are children under a certain age more resistant to anesthesia, or as we get older, do you have to adjust the amount of the drugs that you're using to get the right effect?
You do. In fact, what you can do is this really allows us to personalize the anesthesia care, because you can read the brain state of the patient, take into account how old he or she is. And, you know, one of the places where I think this will have enormous impact is in taking care of specifically of older patients, because, you know, we already realize, or anesthesiologists have known from the empirical work that we talked about earlier, that you need to give older patients less anesthesia. And there are already age-adjusted recommended doses for that. But one of the things that I've seen in my practice is I can cut that back even further if I'm monitoring their EEG, because I can see that they're adequately anesthetized, or in particular unconscious, so I feel quite comfortable giving them less. And the payoff is that they spend less time receiving, you know, large amounts of drugs, which can, you know, have adverse effects on the brain. And the same thing applies on the other end of the age scale, in the sense that, you know, if we realize what it means to be anesthetized based on the EEG patterns, we can use that to more appropriately dose the drugs for children as well.
It sounds like the past decade of research in this field has been incredibly productive. We've learned a lot about how anesthesia actually works in the brain. What for you are some of the big questions still on the horizon in this field?
Well, you see, remember you asked me, you know, why does it matter if you know how it works? And so for me, now that I have some insights into how it works, I can just see something right off the bat, which is that these oscillations that are being generated, they're not natural oscillations. They're oscillations that the drugs generate. They put you in a state so you can undergo surgery. But, you know, it's not a state that your brain goes into by itself. So therefore, they're really pathologic. And so then it just motivates me more to think about how can I do this in such a way that I make you, you know, I put you in the same state effectively, but I have less of this, what I would call pathologic state. And so that motivates me even more to come up with better ways of doing anesthesia, so that it's side effect free. Or let me say it this way. You know, you and I are talking now. Everything is perfectly clear. If you were to undergo surgery, you know, I'd want to have you undergo the surgery. And as soon as we're done, have your brain come right back. And then, you know, we could go on with our conversation perfectly with the same level of, you know, understanding. You'd be perfectly comfortable and, you know, not feel like you've had any cognitive compromise. I mean, that's the goal. And I think that goal comes about now because we have understanding of what the current drugs are doing, or what the current approach is doing.
Emory Brown is director of the Harvard-MIT Health Sciences and Technology Program. He joined me via Skype. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can always find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.